Welcome back for our plenary session. This is our final plenary of the day. All through the lifetime of the Resolve Study, we've been shadowing, in a way, the remarkable transition movement, which has had such an impact locally and also worldwide. And Resolve has had the pleasure of a direct connection with transition via the work, the PhD work that Alexia Koch has been carrying out. But the theme of transition, the example of transition, has been something that's almost co-evolved along with the work the Resolve has been doing. So it's a huge pleasure to have the founder of the transition movement, Rob Hopkins, here, author of the Transition Handbook, and soon to appear, the Transition Companion as well, I think, Rob. So fantastic to have you here. Many thanks for coming along, and you're very welcome to speak.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you very much. I'm going to take a bit of a different tack and really talk about what we've been doing for the last 5 years with transition, which I like to think of as a really big experiment. It's a very simple idea, simple set of tools, simple set of principles that we've put out there, and people in all kinds of places have been trying them out. So I want to really give you a flavour of what that is and what we've been learning from that. And increasingly, particularly for the new book, we start to think of transition as being like a collection of ingredients. So rather than being like a model which says, first you do this, then you do this, and then you do that, and you can't think about doing that until you've done that and that, it's really based on the idea of self-organisation and the idea that people come together, decide they want to do something, and then transition looks different in every place where it emerges. But what we've seen over the last 5 years or so is things that are emerging, which we like to think of as being ingredients. So when you go into your larder and you decide that you want to start cooking, you've got those things there that are available. And what we see, each of those is a problem that we've seen emerge where groups are doing this, and then a solution that we've seen repeated enough times to have some kind of level of confidence that's something that can be replicated. But every place assembles those in a very different way. But what I want to do is to take you through what transition groups are doing so you can get a taste of what that actually looks like on the ground. So transition, just in a graph crash course in what it's all about, is a bottom-up response to peak oil and climate change. And it argues that what you have to do with those things is look at them at the same time. If you just look at climate change on its own, you don't look at peak oil, then the solutions you come up with aren't much use when you get into a very energy-constrained world of very volatile oil prices. Same time, if you just focus on peak oil and you think, my God, we have a liquid fuels problem, we have to get liquid fuels from wherever we can, then from a climate perspective, that's ridiculous. So this bit in the middle is the all-important bit, where you need to plan proactively, intentionally for that transition. It's about powering down in terms of reducing energy consumption, but also we would argue this idea of localization, which I'll talk about a bit more in a minute, and then also powering up in terms of putting in place a new renewable energy infrastructure. And to that, more recently, of course, has been added the economic situation. Mervyn King said the other day, it's not like an ordinary recession where you lose output and get it back quickly. You may not get it back for many years. And that is a big long-run loss on living standards for all people in this country. You know, I think what we're looking at as well is the sort of the unravelling of the debt bubble and more of a sort of economic contraction. These two ideas of localization and resilience are really the two things that I hope you might take away from this talk. So the idea of localization isn't the idea that you put a big fence up around places and don't let anything in or out. It's really the idea that, as Pete North from Liverpool University says, once you pass peak oil, really globalization starts to go into reverse. This is a picture of Totnes, where I've come from today in the 1930s. I just finished, as was said there, a PhD at Plymouth University, and part of that was doing a lot of oral history around the town in the 30s and 40s. One of the things that's very distinctive is this whole area in the middle of the town here was all food production, glass houses, food production tied into three shops on the main street. We talk these days about food miles. There was a system of food feet that we had in place until 1980. It's not to say that actually the 1940s were somehow this sort of resilient sort of nirvana. There were plenty of things about it that were way, way less resilient than today, but there are some things that we can look to and find that are useful. And David Fleming, the economist who died last year, used to say localization stands at best at the limits of practical possibility, but it has a decisive argument in its favor that there will be no alternative. And resilience is really the idea about how you encounter shock from the outside and the ability to weather that, what the Crystal Palace manager Ian Dowell used to call bounce back ability. And so for us, it's really seeing that process of putting back in place an infrastructure that makes places more resilient as an enormous opportunity for places. This idea of localization as economic development, that one of the key places where the livelihoods and so on, the training of the next 15, 20 years is going to come from, is by starting to plug the leaks in our local economies. So transition as it's emerged has different facets to it, really. It's an inner process. It's not just about nuts and bolts and solar panels and carrots. It's also a process which is, I think, very much about learning to support each other as communities through times of increasing uncertainty. It's also about leading by practical example, about showing what's possible and not waiting for permission for anybody just to get on with it. It's an approach which is rooted in place and circumstance. Everywhere you go and you see transition projects happening, they look distinctly different. They have their own quality. They emerge from what's around them. It's a tool for turning problems into solutions, starting to look at how we can take what we have and make something different out of that. It's a cultural shift. I think when we started doing transition, I thought of it as an environmental process, and now 5 years later of having seen it in lots of places, it's really about culture and how do you shift a culture to be ready for times of increasing uncertainty and volatility in that way. And as part of that as well, it's an economic process, which I'll talk about a bit more in a minute, but it's also about storytelling. And it's one of the things that I notice in the transition group that I'm most involved in, is it starts to change the story that the place tells about itself. And I'll come back to that when we come onto that section. So what I want to do is just to give you a taste of what's actually happening. I'm not going to give you lots of theory about transition as an idea and its root in different kind of models and concepts. I really want to give you a taste of what people are actually doing once they've picked up these simple set of tools and actually decided they're going to get on with it. And illustrating that with some of the ingredients that we talk about in the new book. So the first one, coming together as groups, people form around this idea, they want to get on with it. But one of the key things is that actually we're not really that used these days to forming groups with other people. We've become so sort of fragmented and individualized. And actually, the assumption that everybody can just form fantastic groups where after 6 months they don't all want to murder each other or take each other to court is something that needs some work and needs some tools. So in the training that we provide, and we really stress that thing of people need to learn how to actually hold these groups together, because it's not just something... If you go, it's just about doing stuff, we're just going to do stuff, actually you do need more to it than that to hold it together. These kind of brainstorming tools like Open Space, World Cafe, these ways of bringing people together in such a way that their ideas drive and inform the process. If you've ever been around Open Space, fantastic. If you're a control freak, it's terrifying, but it always works. And one of the things in the research I did was using Open Space as a research methodology, which was really interesting in terms of seeing how in the first Open Spaces that we ran in Transition Town Totnes, the ideas, the projects that people came up with, actually when you came back to those things 4 years later, how many of those things had actually happened and were now actually happening on the ground? They're very interesting mechanisms. The whole question of inclusion and diversity and how you work and how you do this in communities that are very, very diverse and different levels of income and so on. Transition Town Tooting last summer ran the Trash Catchers Carnival, which brought together 1,000 people, local schools, mosques, temples. 8,000 people came out to see it. It was the first transition project to be funded by the Arts Council. And one of the key things that came out of it at the end was people said, if we can do that, we can do anything. And I think that's really the spirit that we're trying to foster at that kind of level. And creating visions and telling stories about what this is going to be like. I always think one of the big, big challenges with the whole thing about a post-carbon world, we talk about cutting emissions by 80% by 2050, which actually, as the Tyndall Centre pointed out, something I read recently, is about the carbon emissions of Mozambique today. I mean, I think actually there's a huge gulf in terms of, well, what's that actually going to be like? What's that going to look like and smell like and feel like? And I asked our senior planner, well, describe that world to me. What would it be like? He said, you know, I've never thought of that before. Yeah. I thought, isn't that interesting? That's your job to actually make that happen. But actually, if you don't have an idea of what it's going to be like, why would you get out of bed in the morning to put your shoulder to making that happen? So part of what transition groups do is really finding different ways to try and tell that story and then to backcast and tell the story about how we got there. This is one of the transition groups in Japan doing that. Working with councils is happening all over the country as well in really interesting ways. In Taunton, they did work with the local council there, where all 375 people from the local council came together for a number of sessions to look at and create a vision for the area as a more resilient community. You can find that report online. It's really sort of fed into the lifeblood of the council. And I've brought, I think I'm the only speaker who's brought props today. So one of my props is this really horrible jumper from Taunton that they sent me. And this was because the council did a day which was called a Turn the Heat Down Day, where everybody was told to come. They were going to turn the heating down. Everybody was to come into work wearing a jumper, and there were prizes given for the most horrible jumpers people wore to work, and this was one of them. So what we're seeing is those very practical things that people just get started with actually doing things. And also that transition groups tend to work almost like little R&D units. They try things out, they work like the garden share scheme that Alexia was talking about earlier on today, that these ideas start and then they replicate very quickly out. So this is in Belsize. This is Draft Busters, which was got driven along by Transition Belsize and now is being done by lots of other transition groups in London, a very simple model to pick up and replicate. In Malvern, this is the energy group from Transition Malvern. In Malvern, they have 109 old Victorian gas lamps. They're the things that inspired C.S. Lewis when he wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The gas lamp Lucy sees when she first goes through the door is based on the ones in Malvern. They're all listed. They cost the council a fortune to maintain. They don't actually make very much light. They cost a fortune, about £130 worth of gas every year, £450 a year each to maintain. And the Transition Malvern Energy Group said, well, we can do a bit better than that. They've made over all these lamps, cutting their carbon emissions by 84%, making them 10 times brighter, and they're now planning an anaerobic digestion scheme that would then power these lights with that. This idea of unleashings, transition groups have what they call unleashings quite often, which are the sort of the launch event. They're designed, we always say, they're the event that in 10 years' time people will put a blue plaque up to outside the building as the moment when this process, which had such an impact, started. This was last Christmas, the first transition unleashing in Brazil in one of the favelas in Sao Paulo, which was an extraordinary event that brought the community together to celebrate that. Local food, again, as Alexia was saying this morning, a lot of groups start out around food. It seems to be the thing where you can start to make a visible difference very quickly. So this is in Tooting again. They have a thing called the Foodival. In Tooting, there's lots of people where almost the entire diet is imported from the Indian subcontinent. You can go into shops on the high street there where the whole idea of local food seems completely completely lost, really. So they run this festival where all the growers on the allotments bring all their spare produce down, and then the different chefs from the different restaurants cook it in their different ways, and people come and celebrate that. Again, with local food, this is in Forres in Scotland, the whole thing of communities getting access for land to start setting up, start putting back in place some of that local food infrastructure. This is in Forres, they have about 2 acres, and rather than traditional allotments, which are divided up into rectangles, theirs are divided up into interlocking circles. Getting hold of land as well is important in terms of being able to do that. So here this is in Dorchester, where they're setting up a community farm. It's a local comedy club who held a fundraiser, giving them a very large check on top of a 2CV for some reason. And that's now moving forward as well. So this thing of starting to put in place that kind of infrastructure is really important. And working with schools. Lots of transition groups start to build very productive relationships with the local schools. This is in Newent in the Forest of Dean, where the transition group put up a big polytunnel for the school and are involved in the teaching of growing there. They have a GCSE in environment and land-based studies, which the school has found. And there's this idea, well, if you take kids out of class, then their performance is going to go down. If you take them out of class and get them doing something useful, what they found is that every student who's been doing this GCSE and has been out there learning, to all their other results across the board have gone up, to the extent that the school has actually funded somebody full-time now to run this course. And the thing that was interesting when we started doing the new book was that the idea was, well, what we really want to be seeing is transition groups starting to move towards creating social enterprises around this stuff, transition enterprises which are about starting to make this all happen on the ground in a way that's not grant-dependent and which is viable. And actually, when we started looking around, actually, there were loads of these things already starting to happen. just within that short period of time. So in Kingston upon Thames, Transition Town Kingston, there's this food co-op called From the Ground Up, which has emerged, which is a vegetable box scheme for the area. In Marsden and Slathwaite in Yorkshire, the Transition Group there took over the local shop, grocer shop that had closed down, and reopened it as a community shop. They had about 5 weeks to sort it out. They raised £15,000 in shares in about 3 weeks in order to make it possible. One of the things that they did was when they took over their own grocers, they found that actually as a grocer, all the garlic that you can buy comes from China. And they thought, this is stupid. We actually can grow quite good garlic around here. So they started the Marsden and Slathwaite Garlic Challenge, where everybody who came into the shop got given a clove of garlic and said, we'll buy all the garlic you can grow. And the idea is at least to be self-sufficient in garlic within 2 years, if nothing else. And one of the businesses that worked from there was the Handmade Bakery, who are a fantastic model of how to get young people back into business without having to get enormously in debt with the banks. It's a young couple who wanted to set up a bakery, very inspired by Andrew Whitley's Real Bread campaign. They didn't have any money, so they started as a subscription-based bakery where people bought shares in the bakery. And then what it meant was that 3 years later, when the business was going so well, they wanted to expand into new premises, needed to borrow £30,000 from the bank, who were going to charge them 7% interest. They actually went back to all their subscribers and said, please lend us £30,000, we'll pay you 7% interest in bread, which cost them 2%. Fantastic. So in Devon, Transition Topsham started up, and they did awareness raising. They showed films and so on. They said, you know, after a year, they said, "What is the one thing that really brings people together in this town? Is it peak oil? Is it climate change? Is it beer? I think it may well be." And again, they raised £40,000 in a share option within a few weeks. There were about 55 members who run the brewery. And these kind of things are really, really important, I think. Really powerful story. Prop. We come to that prop in a minute. You're getting ahead of me. He's my prompter, yeah. Not a very good one, but he's... So this whole idea about part of localization is about this idea of how do you make money circulate as many times locally as possible? How do you... New Economics Foundation referred to, and how do you plug the leaks, as it were. So different local currency schemes. This is the Brixton pound. There's the Stroud pound, Totnes pound, various ones of those. The new iteration of that is the Bristol pound and the Lambeth pound, which are going to be mobile phone-based alternative currencies, which will be coming out later near the end of this year. Exploring different ways that you can get money to cycle locally as many times as possible. Now comes the prop. Mm-hmm. This is something that's happened very, very recently, which I think is fantastic. So in Lewis, which is one of the first transition town projects, they worked with the local brewery, Harvey's. And Harvey's has a very big roof, and they decided they wanted to set up the UK's first community solar power station. The local brewery brewed this beer called Sunshine Ale in order to celebrate it. When they launched the Lewis Pound, they did another Brit beer called Quids Inn. And I love the idea. There's something about the idea of local breweries that celebrate the process of a community transitioning itself in the beers that they produce that just fills me with delight. So they are going to put 554 PV panels on the roof of the brewery. They needed to raise £310,000 in 5 weeks with a community share option, which they did. And it's a fantastic project. But where this all starts to go, you know, it starts out with people getting together with friends and neighbours and starting growing stuff or starting thinking about local currencies, this, that, or the other. Where I kind of imagine all of this going, and as we start to see it going, is that it's about thinking strategically, as I said at the beginning, about this process of localisation. So this is in Norwich, Transition Norwich, together with what they called East Anglia Food Link, did a study called Can Norwich Feed Itself? They looked at the city of Norwich, all the land around it, how it's currently grown, what could be grown on that land. They concluded Norwich could feed itself with a certain radius around the city, but they needed a new infrastructure in place. There were certain key things. They needed a new mill. They needed new community farms. They needed more research in terms of oats and beans and other crops that could be grown. So this is Transition Norwich, who then got some funding to do that, having identified those first steps. and there is now a mill getting put in place. This is them on one of the sites where they're setting up a new community farm. There's other ones going in place. So it's not just about randomly sort of doing things in a sort of great enthusiastic whoosh. It's actually about starting to think strategically about how all of this hangs together. And this, and again, putting local infrastructure in place, this is in Edinburgh, Transition Town Portobello, who needed to, who thought the place didn't have a good market. They've put in place a new market. But I think actually when you start looking at the opportunities for that kind of infrastructure, there's enormous opportunities. When you start looking at plugging the leaks, every place where there's money pouring out of the bucket of our local economy is a potential livelihood, a potential local training, a potential local business for somebody. So I want to just talk a little bit about Totnes, which is the, as a case study, and it's the one that I studied in the research that I did. So we started out there 5 years ago doing projects like this. This is a project we do called Totnes, the Nut Tree Capital of Britain. It was called the Nut Capital of Britain, but I think everybody, that's sort of taken as read by this stage. And this is about planting hybrid nut trees throughout the town. You can grow as much protein and carbohydrate a hectare with hybrid walnuts as you can with organically grown wheat. So we've planted nearly 200 now throughout the town, and people look after them. And this is a local solicitor. Every time someone writes a will with his company, he pays for a tree. This man's just set up a will, so they're planting his hybrid walnut tree in town. There's the Garden Share, which was talked about earlier on as well. So this is basically a dating agency that matches up people who want to grow food with people who don't have a... So people who have a garden, they're too elderly or too busy to use, with people who want to grow food and don't have anywhere to grow it. Very, very simple. Doesn't take much time to run. We've never had anyone fall out or it go wrong. There's about 40 families now growing food who weren't able to do so, and it just gets you past that whole allotment waiting list side of things and builds really nice kind of social capital as well. One of the biggest projects we've done was Transition Streets. We were one of the Department of Energy and Climate Change's low carbon communities in 2008, and that enabled us to do Transition Streets. And that's looking at behaviour change on a kind of street by street level. What does it look like if behaviour change comes from the bottom up, with people getting together with the people around them? So there are now, so it goes through three stages. First of all, they meet in groups with their neighbours, 8 to 10 households. They work through a book that we've done. So they meet 7 times. 1 week they look at energy, then they look at water, and then they gather a lot of data that means that we can really see what the impact is. So there are now 500 households that have gone through this scheme. On average, they cut their carbon by about 1.5 tons each, and then they get the grants from the local council for the insulation that they may not have done, and then there are grants for installing solar PV, as we did on the hall in the town. But what's been fantastic about it is actually when I meet people in the town who've done it, they don't say, it's fantastic, we did Transition Streets. We've just saved 1.5 tons of carbon, £800 a year or whatever. What they say is, it's great, we now know so-and-so over the road, and us and so-and-so over there, we're now doing this together. So actually the social side of it has been way more impactful on people. And it's really interesting to see what it looks like when it comes in that direction. One of the things that I think is an enormous problem is still the fact that when our councils plan for our future, they do so based on assumptions that are just completely inappropriate. You know, the idea that in 10 years' time we'll have more cheap energy than today, more economic growth than today, this whole thing of, well, when we get back to growth again, everything will be all right, and that's what we're planning for. We're planning for the getting back to it. What if that's not the case? And what if we actually plan as a community for the intentional localization of the place that we live? So we did a project, ran for about 1.5 years, that was a kind of community visioning storytelling program, which you can find there. That really started to set out the steps that we saw. I had a study in it called Can Totnes Feed Itself? Had a Can Totnes Power Itself? Really looking at the energy potential of the area as well. And from that, we identified a number of projects that we think of as the catalyst projects. How do you actually take this idea of localization as economic development and actually ground it in the community in something which is viable? And so some of those projects are now moving forward. This is Transition Homes, which is going to be building affordable housing for people on the housing list, but using predominantly local materials, saying that actually every time we build, we should be using that opportunity to try and support the emerging new businesses in terms of materials. In Ebervale in Wales, they've just built 2 local passive houses that reach a passive house standard but use 80 or 90% local materials to actually build them, which is a really exciting thing. We set up our own energy company, the Totnes Renewable Energy Society. Nearly 400 people in the town now have shares in that, and its plan is to put two wind turbines on the edge of Totnes. So these kind of models whereby communities can invest into themselves in ways that they then own and manage that project in the long run are really, really important, I think. And the one that we're really focused on at the moment is, any of you who've ever been to Totnes will know that you get off the train and you're met with a sort of rather grotty-looking, falling-to-bits old industrial plant, which used to be a milk processing plant, has a listed building on it, built by Isambard Kingdom Brunel. And actually, we want to get that site and develop it like Coin Street, as something which is done and managed by the community. And we have a meeting in a week where we're hoping to emerge. We're working with Bioregional Quintain and looking to do something really, really interesting on that site. So keep your fingers crossed for us next Monday afternoon. And actually, what I wanted to close with was just two things that are really quite silly, but then, hey, you've had a long day looking at lots of graphs. So one of the things that's in the Transition Companion is some newspaper articles from the future. This whole thing, as I was saying before, you know, what would it smell like and feel like and sound like if we actually woke up in that world? And so one of the things that we do in various places, try and tell some of those stories. What would be the newspaper article stories from the future? So this, there's just two, but this one is about Cheryl Tweedy, I think she's called now, and her husband, then living in LA, who've just separated because due to gardening differences. They met on a show called Strictly Come Mulching, and the idea of the program was that they were going to make over their ranch into a vegetable garden. But they reached an impasse where actually he was determined to grow everything very straight and have flowers everywhere and do things very curvaceously. And she was determined that actually she just wanted to grow veg in straight rows, very traditional allotment kind of style thing. And they just couldn't cope with it, and it led to them separating. And then this other one is from... This is a story from Bath in about 2020 called Midnight Aquaculture Revelers Infuriate Local Brewer. Lansdowne Road was one of ten of Bath's hilliest streets, which 5 years ago were pedestrianised and redeveloped into terraced fish ponds and food production beds. Visitors to the city are invited to help themselves to salads, but not the fish. And the Hanging Gardens of Bath Avon, as they've become dubbed, have become a major tourist attraction. Residents alongside the gardens take turns in tending the ponds and the beds, and in spite of initial resistance and concerns about infestations of slugs lowering house prices, the scheme has been a huge hit. So last year, our publican here decided to try something new, where he used the spent hops from his brewery to make biogas to heat one of these ponds, so that he could experiment in trialing rice crops and water chestnuts. But last Saturday night, however, he had a shock. "I came out of the pub after closing time," he said, "and there in my heated pools were about 15 people in various states of undress, carrying on and having a party as though they were in a jacuzzi. I gave them a piece of my mind. I told them this is a groundbreaking urban aquaculture research project, not a bloody 18 to 30s holiday. I sent them packing with a flea in their ear. The pools are now fenced off while John decides what to do next, although he did tell the Bath Chronicle that he is considering to breed crayfish, something with a nasty bite." So if you're interested in anything else about Transition, you want to find out anything else, transitionnetwork.org, you can search by initiatives in terms of is the place you live already doing this, rather than recreating the wheel. You can also search it by projects, all the projects that are underway, and also by the individuals who are involved. And I do a blog called Transition Culture. And Transition Companion, out in September, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Rob. Now, we've